And I don't know how the Russians are able to be a major military power and exporter if they can't make spare parts, if they don't have access to semiconductors, if their top human capital has fled the country, for other places and not coming back. This was perhaps the single greatest misjudgment made by any major leader on the geopolitical stage since the wall fell in 1989.
Hallo und herzlich willkommen zu einer neuen Folge von Handelsblatt Disrupt, dem Podcast über neue Ideen, Disruption und die Zukunft in einer geopolitisch immer unruhigeren Welt. Mein Name ist Sebastian Mattes und ich begrüße Sie ganz herzlich aus unserem Podcaststudio hier in Düsseldorf. Was bedeutet die Zeitenwende, ausgelöst durch den Ukraine-Krieg, langfristig für die geopolitische und wirtschaftliche Weltordnung? Welche Folgen hat die technologische Entkopplung zwischen Ost und West? Und was bedeutet es eigentlich für Europa, wenn sich die USA und China zunehmend feindselig gegenüberstehen? Das bespreche ich heute mit einem der weltbekanntesten politischen Analysten, dem Gründer der Eurasia Group, Ian Bremmer. Er ist Politikwissenschaftler, der Erfinder des globalen Weltrisikoindexes, Autor zahlreicher Bücher und internationaler Experte für geopolitische Risiken. In unserem Gespräch, das viele überraschende Einblicke und Zahlen bietet, erklärt Bremmer übrigens auch, warum es nicht nur der akute Ukraine-Konflikt ist, der ihm derzeit die größten Sorgen macht, sondern eine technologische Entwicklung.
Nach einer kurzen Unterbrechung geht es gleich weiter. Bleiben Sie dran.
Sie leben Fairness, Kultur und Werte? Zeigen Sie Ihr Engagement als Arbeitgeber und werden Sie Teil der Fair Company Initiative. Mit der Fair Company Initiative zeichnet das Handelsblatt Unternehmen aus, die insbesondere Berufseinsteigern und Young Professionals ein faires, attraktives Arbeitsumfeld bieten. Zu den entscheidenden Werten gehören unter anderem das Engagement für Mitarbeitende, Diversity und Chancengleichheit, Nachhaltigkeit und gesellschaftliche Verantwortung. Erfahren Sie jetzt mehr unter faircompany.de.
Und damit zu meinem Gespräch mit Ian Bremmer, den ich jetzt in seinem New Yorker Büro erreiche. Hi Ian, great to have you here.
Sebastian, good to be with you.
So for many years, geopolitical developments haven't been as much in focus as today. So maybe let's start with a more general view. What is the state of the world right now? And what will the world look like maybe in, let's say, 10 years from now? How will it be different from the last decade?
Well, the state of the world right now is what I call a geopolitical recession. It's a bust cycle where the institutions and the architecture are no longer aligned with the underlying balance of power. And that creates a lot more volatility. It also creates a lot more room for crises. And of course, there are many crises that we face right now, but the one that's been most urgent that you and I have been chatting about over the past months has been the Russian invasion of Ukraine, which is, of course, a much more global problem than that. It is the return of a Cold War between the advanced industrial democracies and Russia, and it has elements of a hot war. And I think that it is that, not Ukraine itself, but that, which is something that will define the next 10 years. And not only is that a development that will further strengthen and align the advanced industrial democracies together, but it is also driving a greater wedge between the countries of North and South, between the wealthy and the developing countries. And both of those things are happening at the same time.
I think this kind of recession you just mentioned is something pretty new. I guess it needs new kind of answers. We will definitely talk a little bit more closely about it, but maybe to start with, what is the difference in answering to this kind of crisis you just mentioned?
Well, economic recessions happen pretty frequently. The world is probably about to enter yet another one. We know if they're large or small. We know how to define them, although President Biden is playing around with that right now. That we have fiscal and monetary tools to effectively respond to an economic recession. And by the way, that's true whether you're United States, you're Germany, or you're China, right? The tools are basically the same. Geopolitical recessions do not happen as often. The cycles are very long. Because when you build institutions, they are aligned at that time with the powers that really have the most influence on the global stage. And the change in balance of power happens slowly and incrementally while the institutions are sticky. So this plays out over generations, not over years. And it takes a while to recognize that you're in a geopolitical recession when it hits. I mean, I first wrote about what I call a G0 world some 10 years ago in 2012. And at the time that I wrote that book, there were a lot of people that said, well, that's an interesting idea. It's a potential scenario, but that's probably not where we're going to be. It took a decade for people around the world to recognize, actually, yeah, it's non-polar. The Americans aren't acting as the world policeman. They're not the global architect of trade anymore. They're not even the cheerleader of global values. And by the way, nobody is capable of taking the place of the United States. I think that the election of Donald Trump helped make that more obvious, but it's so much deeper and more structural than one president of one country in the world.
Ian, what could an answer be to that threat? Do we need new institutions, or do we have just to accept that the world will somehow decouple from now on?
There is decoupling that's happening, but it is precisely the existence of these crises that have the seeds of the answers to them. And let's give you two quick examples of that. One, Putin is not particularly different today than he was in 2014. The major difference is that he sensed much greater opportunity because of what happened in Afghanistan, because of Biden's perceived weakness, because Merkel was no longer there in Germany, because France was talking about strategic autonomy going its own way, because China was willing to stand up with Putin on the global stage and say, you're my best friend without global limits. And that led Putin to not only take greater steps in Ukraine, but to miscalculate and to create precisely the kind of crisis that led the West to reform its institutions, led the Germans to say, no, we're going to spend 2% of our GDP on defense going forward. The Finns and the Swedes saying, actually, no, we're going to join NATO. The Japanese, the South Koreans, the Australians, New Zealanders saying, no, we're actually going to come to the Madrid summit because a European security challenge is an Asian security challenge too. These are precedents that are completely linked and we have to work together. So, I mean, frankly, despite president after president in the United States saying we need to do more and doing very little, it was precisely Putin's decision to create a true global emergency, at least on the European continent and for NATO, that then had the seeds of a global response. By the way, I would argue that climate change playing out over a much longer period of time, you see this exact same sort of thing. I mean, you know, in 2014, Russia invaded Ukraine. No one did very much about it. 20 years ago, we all knew that climate was a growing problem, but it was a glowing problem for, you know, the Maldives and for polar bears and for trees. And so you had a bunch of activists that were talking about it, but it wasn't a global response until it started hitting California and Louisiana and Italy and Germany and Australia and everywhere, coming soon to a theater near you. And suddenly there was only one side to be on global climate. Denialism didn't work anymore. And you see trillions and trillions of dollars being spent and invested into renewable energy and into nuclear. And frankly, the Chinese doing so much that even Americans that don't care about climate change say, well, if we don't invest, we're going to be left behind and China's going to be the post-carbon energy superpower. So I do think, and this is a big theme of the latest book that I've written called The Power of Crisis. That, I mean, nobody wants to see these crises. I mean, the Ukrainians are suffering for the short-sightedness and the sins of a lack of global leadership for decades now. And so too are the Maldivians and others that are experiencing, sub-Saharan Africa's experiencing unlivable climate conditions. I mean, 1 billion Indians that can't work outside after 10 a.m. because it's too hot for them to do so. But the world is not allowing their tragedy to sit in vain. And I think that that's not necessarily optimism. It is hopefulness. It is a recognition that actually we can, as a planet, come together to respond.
I was just about to come to your book because you mentioned an interesting thing. You wrote about the major three threats and focused on climate change, COVID-19, technological disruption. And you also said that a major crisis would in the end somehow unite the world in its efforts to tackle all those threats. Is this war in the Ukraine and everything that happened since then, is that this major crisis that is somehow uniting the West?
It's uniting the West, absolutely. Whether it will continue to do so for 5 or 10 years is an interesting and open question. I mean, if the United States were to experience a constitutional crisis in 2024 with a lot of violence, and we don't know who the president is for a period of time, Ukraine does not have the same existential threat to the Americans. It doesn't have the millions of refugees that the Europeans are presently welcoming. Doesn't have the energy relevance, the commodities relevance for the Americans that it does for the Europeans. I could imagine that the U.S. will be spending a lot less time paying attention to this issue in a couple of years than they are presently. So I wouldn't want to be Pollyannish on that. But I do think that Ukraine, for the time being, has really motivated and mobilized a true global response from the United States and its advanced industrial democratic allies. I also want to be clear that that is not the case of other democracies around the world.
Yes, we will talk about the others. But what we are seeing now in Europe is that especially when it comes to energy, Europe will be divided pretty soon because there's discussion about if some countries should get Russian oil anyway, and some discussions about Nord Stream 2 turning it on anyway. Might this crisis in the end also divide the West?
It's possible. I am somewhat more hopeful there than the framing of your question. It is obvious that the Hungarians, for example, are not fully on board with the Europeans on a number of issues here, and they've demanded exceptions and carve-outs on energy in their willingness to go ahead and vote along with the Europeans in what is now, we've seen, 7 different rounds of sanctions against Russia. But I want to be clear. Those 7 rounds of sanctions are unprecedented in their unity and severity against a G20 member economy. We've never seen it before. And the also unanimous vote of all European Union members to bring on board Ukraine and Moldova as candidate members is unprecedented. It's basically embracing that the Ukraine war is a European war. So yes, you're absolutely right that as we look forward to this winter, there's going to be a lot of economic pain on the backs of European citizens, and that will create a level of political discomfort around how severe the sanctions against Russia have been. You're also going to have a new Italian government, probably run by the far right, that's supportive of Ukraine, that opposes Russia, but nonetheless will be less aligned with the European Union and a bunch of policies on the economic side. So I accept that there will be some wobbling of the EU and its members on this issue. But overall, I think the surprise is the consolidation.
Do you see Europe having a very cold winter?
Yes, I do. I absolutely do. But I think it will be a warmer winter in 2023-24, and it will be a normal winter by 2024-25, precisely because of the sacrifice and the rapidity with which all of the major economies in Europe have responded to this crisis.
Before we get deeper into that and also obviously talk about the role of China in all this geopolitical discussions, I would like to talk about yourself. You've devoted your life to analyzing and understanding political risks. How did this all start? Is that something you choose as a profession, or did you slip into it somehow? So what was the beginning for this idea and for your company?
Well, first of all, recognize that I loved political science as a topic. When I was a kid, I played Risk in high school. I read The Economist. I was kind of wonky that way. And my first trip outside the United States ever, I grew up in the projects, didn't have any money. Dad died when I was four. My mom didn't have a high school education. So I wasn't like one of these kids that was going to Europe or whatever in the summertime. Like, that was not happening. I was baking at home. I went to the Soviet Union in 1986, a trip led by a professor of mine in college. Gorbachev had just come in. I was blown away. I couldn't believe that something existed that was so radically other to everything in my personal experience. And furthermore, that it didn't seem to be understood as such by other Americans that I knew. So I really had the bug of trying to understand the world. And I majored in poli-sci. Afterwards, I got a PhD because I was really young in college. I was 15. So, I mean, I wasn't really ready for a full-time job. But when I finished my PhD, my intention was not to become an academic. It was to go get a job. And I will say I was a little surprised that, you know, the private sector didn't hire political scientists. There wasn't really a field of applied political science the way there is behavioral economics, yeah. Right? And so if it didn't exist, that kind of meant I was going to have to create it. And I mean, I didn't mean that in a grandiose way. I just meant that I had to go out there and hustle and get some people to take me on board as clients, you know, if they weren't going to hire me full time. And 25 years later, we've got 200 people and a global business, and there's a real industry, which is kind of exciting.
Absolutely. And maybe not everybody has really followed what your company is doing. So you have some of the biggest companies of the world as customers. So what do you do for them? What is your service?
Well, we try to help them understand the world, and specifically how the world is not necessarily completely aligned with their mission, and business.
So how does that work? Do you send them reports, or do they ask you questions?
Yes and yes, but I mean, the bigger of the relationships and the ones where we're really moving the needle for them are, of course, much more bespoke. They're very tailored. They're a significant number of senior people in our organization getting to understand what those companies are about, and specifically where the pressure points are between where they're heading as organizations and where the world is heading. And, you know, they're not experts on the world. They're experts on their company. And so as a consequence, if the world is changing quickly, the global order, global architecture, global institutions, global values, then frequently they're playing catch up. And to the extent that we can help them, we do. And by the way, that's not just about companies. We also have an events organization. We have a media company that we started so that we can help, you know, just citizens around the world also inform themselves more effectively and be maybe 10% less crazy when they're being consumed by the media.
So when, for example, when I'm the CEO of a international corporate and I want to maybe diversify and move away from China, and I want to understand how secure is it to go to Vietnam, what are the maybe risks to go there, you would give me some answers.
We'd certainly try, but we'd also want to make sure that your decision to diversify China was based in a real assessment of where the world is and is going, as opposed to a knee-jerk reaction to, I can't do any business in China going forward.
Okay. You think about how to explain what's happening in the world to your customers, to people all over the world. One question I found very interesting that somebody asked me a couple of weeks ago on a big event was, how can we explain what's going on in the world now to our children? Do you have an answer for that as well?
Well, I think that the easiest way to answer that is to say that our children are actually much more global than they used to be. 90% of people under 21 today are in developing countries, and they're increasingly urban, they're increasingly educated, and they're increasingly connected. So young people actually are much more global and much less Western than they were when you and I were growing up. And of course, my own experience of young people also was so much more narrow. It was the kids I was playing stickball with living in my block. And today, you're online and you're playing Fortnite on Twitch with kids from all over the world, or you're talking about BTS and their breakup. I mean, these are fundamentally global kids, and you know, they actually look at a relatively small number of elites, mostly from the advanced industrial economies, who have made decisions for the planet that are not necessarily going to leave the world for the kids today in the kind of circumstance that they would want it to be, and they're angry about that. They're cynical about it too. And so you need to break through. You need to, first of all, understand that. You need to listen to them. Right? I mean, it's not just a one-way street. By the way, one thing that I was very respectful about Chancellor Scholz for doing at the most recent G7 was when he reached out and invited the leaders of a number of those countries like Senegal and Argentina to join the G7. And he told Biden and the other attendees, we're not here to lecture them. We're here to listen. So let's really let them tell us what they think and how we're getting it wrong. And we need to digest that. We can't just immediately say, oh, we have all the answers, because that's not the way they feel. I think increasingly that's what we need to do with young people.
Will the young people live in a completely different world? I mean, when we were young, we could travel almost everywhere. We could start a company in many countries pretty easily. This will definitely change, right?
Well, again, it wasn't easy for me to travel anywhere when I was a kid, and I didn't know anyone that started a company. So I would take some issue with that as someone that grew up in a very different class situation than perhaps you did. But certainly from the 1970s when I grew up until, say, 2001, when this, 1991, the Soviet Union collapses, 2001, when we had 9/11, I do think there was this age of opportunity in the West, and there was also an age of globalization where a global middle class was developing and felt like they had increasing opportunities going forward. It is not as clear, given climate change, given the rise of populism in democracies all over the world, given the unwind of some aspects of decoupling from globalization, the West and Russia, the U.S. and China on the technology side, and of course, grassroots populism all over the world, making market access more problematic. You put those things together, and you wouldn't expect the same levels of overall global growth that we've experienced over the past 50 years. It's a different type of challenge in different places. In China, there's a big demographic challenge on top of that. In the United States, there's a big tribal political challenge on top of that. But certainly, the message that I would give to young people today is, on the one hand, the world is going to be a lot more challenging. On the other hand, the institutions are up for grabs. So it's not just a small number of elites running a few governments around the world that are creating the new institutions for the 21st century. It's corporations, it's banks, it's NGOs, it's people. It's much more diffuse. And that ultimately creates a sense of opportunity and a sense of hope in ways that for many decades ago, if they weren't on the right track, they might as well shut it down.
What is the most important qualifications for young people when they want to succeed in this new world? Is that something you thought about?
It is. I think there are three things that you need One is you have to have content, you have to have substance. If you don't have some level of expertise in what you're passionate about, then no one's going to pay any attention to you. And you always have to, I mean, I'm not surprised given who I am as a human being that I would start with that, but I think it's critically important. And if you start believing your own story and stop paying attention to content, which requires in a deeply complex world, continual engagement and study, it's not just 10,000 hours and you can stop, then you lose the ball game. That's number one. Number two, as you and I are seeing today, you have to be able to communicate effectively, because if you have great content, but you can't tell anyone what that content is in a way that will resonate with them, in a way that will touch them, will engage them, and that message needs to be adapted so that people of all different walks of life can understand and connect with it, then you're not going to be effective. And then third is absolutely critically important, is you have to understand how the system works and how you can get to decision makers, gatekeepers, and stakeholders. I mean, you and I, for Christ's sake, met in Davos. That is not something that is available to the vast majority of people on the planet. And by the way, it wasn't available to me until I got myself an invite. And, you know, that's hard. And figuring that out is almost impossible for a lot of incredibly talented people with great communication skills. And we need to be deeply sensitive to that reality, right? That it's not, land of opportunity doesn't just happen. And there is an accident of birth is extraordinarily important. And for me, makes me kind of I'm a patriot, but I'm not a nationalist. Because for me, nationalism is the sense that somehow by virtue of the incredible good fortune you had to be born in a certain place at a certain time, that that makes you and your country better and you as a human being more worthwhile than others around the world without that fortune. And that is a whole load of bullshit that I have no interest in peddling.
Let's come back for a second and talk about Russia and about Putin's intentions. What do you think Putin really wants in the end? And what could be a way out of this whole crisis?
Unfortunately, it's very hard for me to see a way out of the crisis now 5 months in, because under any circumstances, any plausible scenario, I believe that Putin will end up in a materially worse economic, political, and geostrategic position than he would have been in had he not decided to invade Ukraine on February 24th. And clearly, that is not an acceptable outcome for Putin. Now, you know, if he takes all of the Donbass, if he keeps the land bridge to Crimea, he holds on to Kherson, he can announce that he's been successful in his second special military operation, as he mislabels it. But that is still leaving Ukraine more integrated with NATO than they were before, as a candidate member of the European Union, with the entire country wanting him dead. And convinced that he has convinced thousands upon thousands of war crimes upon their nation of 44 million. Not to mention the fact that NATO has expanded, it'll be stronger, it'll be more forward deployed in terms of troops, and Russia will be fully cut off and decoupled from the economies of the G7 plus. So this is, I mean, he can say it's a win at home, and I'm sure he will, but it's an unacceptable long-term position for Putin to be in. And I do believe that their economy over the next 5 years is likely to be on a similar trajectory to Iran's economy after they were made into a G7 pariah. In other words, a contraction of some 30 to 50%. And I don't know how the Russians are able to be a major military power and exporter if they can't make spare parts, if they don't have access to semiconductors, if their top human capital has fled the country, for other places and not coming back. This was perhaps the single greatest misjudgment made by any major leader on the geopolitical stage since the wall fell in 1989.
So you say the sanctions are working, because what we are seeing is that Putin can sell oil, for example, to India, even to Saudi Arabia. He's selling oil at the moment.
At a massive discount. Yes, that's right.
Yes. Yeah, sure. But still, he is earning billions with that. Do you still think the economy will go down in the next couple of years?
Yeah, well, this year, the Russian economy is going to contract by some 7 to 8%. That's basically a depression, and it's been completely imposed by the West. So number one, let's recognize that it's very hard to say that the economy is doing well, that's decreasing by 7 to 8%. If that happened in...
No, sure, but it's not... It could be worse, right? I mean, many thought it would... Yes.
No, of course it could be worse. Yeah, I mean, we could be bombing them. We're not. But I mean, I'm just, when people tell me the sanctions aren't working, like, I mean, if Germany were experiencing a contraction of 7 to 8% of their economy as opposed to growth of 2% or 3%, there would be pitchforks on the streets calling for your chancellor's head. So I just don't accept the idea that sanctions are not working this year. Now, by the way, that is in an environment where the Europeans still need to buy this energy, and they won't be in that position in another 2 years' time. We know that. That's number one. Number two is Russia is a manufacturing economy. So yes, we still will need oil and gas around the world and food, and they'll be able to sell that. But everything else they do will be a disaster. And half of their assets were frozen by the West. No one expected that to happen. They're not going to get unfrozen. All the foreign direct investment from the West has been turned off. You want to go to the new McDonald's? They don't have French fries and their buns are molded. I mean, I got to tell you, the Russians are pretty pissed off about the fact that all of this has been happening. And so it is true that, I mean, you don't have major demonstrations in Russia right now against Putin, and the consequences of demonstrating are, of course, very severe for yourself and your family. And the Russian economy is muddling through. The ruble, of course, is doing well, but that's artificial. It's because you can't use it to buy anything. The Soviet ruble did well, too. It was a closed economy. That tells you nothing. But if you think about the next 3 to 5 years, Russia's economy is on a trajectory that Iran has been on over the past 20. Literally, this is unprecedented.
Nach einer kurzen Unterbrechung geht es gleich weiter. Bleiben Sie dran.
Wie wird unsere Wirtschaft eigentlich klimaneutral? Das ist eine der wichtigsten Fragen unserer Zeit. Und das Erste, was wir dafür loswerden müssen, sind auf jeden Fall fossile Denkweisen. In der Handelsblatt Green Innovation Week dreht sich deshalb vom 6. bis zum 10. Mai alles darum, wie die Klimawende gelingen kann. Und welche nachhaltigen Entscheidungen Sie jetzt für sich und Ihr Unternehmen treffen können. Seien Sie dabei. Digital, im Blatt, als Podcast und live. Mehr unter handelsblatt.com/greeninnovationweek.
For a G20 economy.
Pretty important for the Russian economy is also what China is doing the next couple of years. So how do you see the role of China?
They're buying less oil from Russia than the Indians are because their economy is not growing very fast, the consequence of zero COVID primarily and the lockdowns they've had. China just brought, for the first time ever, their Belt and Road investments into Russia to zero. There are none. And that's because they don't want to be caught in secondary sanctions by the United States and the West. They are not providing direct military support to the Russians after being warned by the Americans, don't do it or else. They are engaged in continued trade with Russia, but the Russian economy is one-tenth the size of China. And so it's not exactly a critical partner for the Chinese going forward. I fully believe that developing countries around the world will keep doing business with Russia, and China will as well in that bucket. But that's very different from saying that China is somehow the Russian savior.
Mm. But still, Russia is hoping to get high tech from China. And will China be this partner in the next couple of years for Russia?
I think that Russia's technology systems will be increasingly lined with those of China. I think if Russia's going to roll out 5G effectively, it'll be with Chinese systems. I think a lot of their internet will have to be integrated with China. And that also probably means data surveillance, which is problematic for Russia long term. Look, it's not good for the West that Russia and China have parallel worldviews, that the Russians think that they're being contained by the Americans and so do the Chinese. But China wants to keep doing business with the entire world, and that includes the US and Germany and Japan. Russia is no longer in that position. So Russia has a lot more in common with the Iranians today, and that's why you saw Russia and Putin, the first trip that he's made post-war was actually to Tehran to go and meet with President Raisi. He hasn't been to China. That, I think, sends a fairly significant message. If Xi Jinping were inviting him, Putin would be there.
But still, even if China is not completely backing Russia, there's a decoupling going on between China and the US and many other countries. What will this decoupling between China and the West mean for the world economy?
I think that there are limits on how much decoupling will occur between the US and China. First of all, because the economies are very interdependent and both countries have very entrenched economic power bases that do not want to unwind that, whether it's China and their desire to export, China, their desire to have exposure to U.S. treasuries because they're safe and perform well, China, because they want their kids to have access to American universities, they want to buy real estate in the United States, and the Americans who, I mean, want to be able to have access to the Chinese market, want to produce in China. I mean, you know, whether you're Walmart, your Coca-Cola, your NBA, I mean, most American corporations see China as an expanding market over time, not a decreasing one. And Japan too. Yeah.
Sure. In Germany, the same. So many German companies are wondering whether they should diversify from China or pull back investment from China. So what would be your advice?
I think that if you are in areas of advanced technology that have the potential to have direct national security implications, whether it's robotics or whether it's 5G or whether it's advanced artificial intelligence or quantum computing or some areas of biotechnology, these are areas that will face greater regulatory scrutiny and as a consequence will see greater decoupling over time. And so absolutely, if you're a firm in one of those fields or touching one of those fields, you're going to have to be more cautious. You're going to have to diversify. For companies in other areas of the economy, I don't see that. I do see greater problems in investing in China going forward, in part because China doesn't have rule of law, and also because China is experiencing very significant economic challenges. Their demographics, it looks like from this Shanghai Academy of Sciences report that came out last month and was immediately suppressed by the Chinese government, that they reached peak population, not in 2028, as we were expecting and projecting, but rather last year, and that the contraction of their economy and their consumer base is going to be unprecedented over the course of coming generations. That will make China less attractive as an economy. And it will also mean that there's not going to be a Chinese century that anyone's been talking about. Now, having said that, it's still the second largest economy in the world. It's still on track to become number one, even if not for long. And of course, that means that a lot more companies are going to be investing there.
For many years, China has focused primarily on growth and increasing wealth. And now that focus is somehow shifting to nationalism and control. Where is that taking us in terms of economic development?
Well, that's true in the United States as well. And no one's telling German companies you should invest less in the United States, not least when the US dollar is at parity with the euro for the first time in decades. Look, I do believe that the Chinese government is under more strain economically. Zero COVID's making it harder. Significant non-performing corporate debt and a real estate bubble is making it harder. Rural banks collapsing in the last couple weeks have made it harder. So the Chinese economic story is not just a boom story. We need to understand that. And that's true in an environment where a government run by the Chinese Communist Party does not support rule of law. So I think that it's going to be harder to make significant cash in China in the next 10, 20 years that it has been for the last 20. I accept that. But I still see that outside the United States, every major economy out there says, do not put us in a position where we have to choose between the US and China. We're going to invest in both. That's still going to be the answer.
Ian, before we wrap up now, I would like to talk about another country, another boom country that is getting in economic trouble right now. I've talked to a number of managers and founders from Silicon Valley a couple of weeks ago, and they told me, off the record, of course, some of them are making real life exit plans because they are worried about the political divide in the US. One even mentioned civil war.
Yeah. no one's talking about a civil war, but lots of people are talking about a broken election, a constitutional crisis in 2024 that we haven't seen since 1876 during the period of Reconstruction. There is unprecedented tribalism and political dysfunction in Washington, and we're also seeing blue states versus red states becoming harder for companies to navigate. Disney in California, blue, Florida, red, harder for them, more costly for them to try to deal with that. A lot of companies are trying to navigate what it means for them to, you know, be able to be all things to all people politically when what they're really trying to do is just sell sneakers, right? So it is harder, but it's harder in the context of a U.S. economy that's doing incredibly well, a dollar that's only been strengthening, you know, world's major oil producer, food producer, you know, the only open economy in the world with superpower-sized technology companies that are driving in, you know, every area of entrepreneurship. These things matter an awful lot. And so it's interesting. In China, you have a consolidated political system that's very stable with an economy that's increasingly wobbly. In the United States, you have an incredibly strong economy with a political system that's increasingly wobbly. And that latter point is one that's causing a lot of CEOs a great deal of discomfort.
And is there a way out for this divide we're seeing in the US?
Not in the near term. It's been growing for decades. And you saw January 6th. I mean, the reality was it wasn't a big enough crisis to lead to a conviction of Donald Trump. It wasn't a big enough crisis to get the Republicans to participate in the January 6th commission, which tends to tell you that the next time around, it's probably going to be worse.
What is your biggest fear when you think about the next years?
Oh, my biggest fear is probably that we have a host of disruptive technologies that we are developing that are increasingly in the hands of a whole bunch of governments and even non-state actors that can be used for good, but also for great danger. And that we are not yet in any way working together to try to limit the proliferation of those technologies.
For example, what kind of technology?
The way the Americans and the Soviets did during the Cold War. What kind of technologies? Well, lethal autonomous drones, quantum computing and encryption, artificial intelligence that is undifferentiated from human beings online. Offensive cyber weaponry. I mean, we just have a whole bunch of new technologies that are potentially existential in their manifestation globally, and we aren't yet doing anything to try to limit the potential downside.
Mm. And why are you still optimistic or positive, as you've said in the beginning?
The alternative is pretty negative, but I'm an existential optimist. I don't think that you and I could be having this conversation today and not be just wondrous about the fact that we even exist. We've done nothing to deserve it. The fact that we actually see that there's more room for people like us to make a difference in the world should empower us. I mean, I know that if my mother were still alive, she'd slap me senseless if I got despondent with everything that the world has given me in this first 50 years on the planet.
Thank you so much, Ian. So we have to talk about all these threats next time. Thank you so much for your time and
sure.
See you soon.
Sounds good, man.
Und damit sind wir auch schon wieder am Ende von Handelsblatt Disrupt. Wie immer freue ich mich über Kommentare in der Handelsblatt Disrupt LinkedIn-Gruppe oder senden Sie mir gerne eine Mail. Die Details finden Sie wie immer in den Shownotes. Danke an dieser Stelle auch für die Unterstützung von Marcel Joschko und Regina Körner und Migo Fecke von professionalpodcast.com, dem Dienstleister für Strategieberatung und Podcastproduktion. Wenn Sie grundsätzlich immer auf dem Laufenden sein wollen, dann testen Sie doch gern das Handelsblatt in unserem Sommerspezialangebot. Damit lesen Sie jetzt alle aktuellen Artikel und Recherchen im Archiv für 6 Wochen im Vorteilsabo. Schauen Sie doch einfach mal nach unter handelsblatt.com/sommerspecial. Die Details dazu finden Sie auch in den Shownotes. Wir hören uns dann nächste Woche Freitag wieder. Bis dahin wünsche ich Ihnen interessante digitale, aber natürlich auch analoge Zeiten. Ihr Sebastian Mattes.
Willkommen in der Zukunft der Technologie mit dem Handelsblatt Summit Zukunft IT. Seien Sie Teil der IT-Flagship-Tagung des Handelsblatts, bei welcher führende Köpfe der IT-Branche zusammenkommen, um die neuesten Trends und Herausforderungen der digitalen Transformation zu diskutieren. Vernetzen Sie sich mit Branchenführern und finden Sie Lösungen, die Ihr Unternehmen voranbringen. Exklusiv für unsere Podcast-Hörer sichern Sie sich jetzt 20% Rabatt auf Ihre Anmeldung. Besuchen Sie zukunft-it.jetzt und verwenden Sie den Vorteilscode PODCAST.